Be mindful you have a creator, young man. Your days of young manhood just now, when you can, before days arrive in calamitous sight, the years pounce when you say there is no delight. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, that is, for today's scripture from verse 1 of that chapter, of Ecclesiastes chapter 12, from the Word Green version of 2004. Today's scripture from the book of Ecclesiastes of King Solomon, Little Children. And returning to our study of the article, The Ark of Urartu, and I would love to at some point cover this video that was made by the wife, or the former wife, prior to Ron's passing, of Ron Wyatt, his wife, who knew all about the work he was doing and was able to tell detailed accounts of the things he did in his investigation of Mount Sinai, for example, in Saudi Arabia. The Mount Sinai that Ron discovered was on the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the east arm of the Red Sea. And that Mount Sinai was, of course, different from the one that was traditional, as well as the one that we found, which were both in the Sinai Peninsula. But I would love to show that video, because I think it's about 30 minutes long, if I recall, but I'm not sure where I saw it now. Let me see if I can find it here. That one. It's somewhere in my history. I'm not sure if I know where it is. Maybe it's here. No. Yeah, while I'm on the topic, it would be very useful if somebody would produce a consumer version of the toe fungus laser treatment that clinics provide, where they have a powerful enough laser with blue light and infrared light, and it kills the fungus behind the toenail by shining the light through the toenail after the toenail has been thinned down sufficiently. But that those lasers that they use at the clinics are much more powerful than the ones you can buy online that are battery powered, and the battery's not powerful enough, I believe. So if they could produce a version that was based on 120 volts or 240 volts, I really believe that it would be a product that could be usable, useful, I mean, for home use. However, it would have to be produced economically for it to be viable, because a treatment that nowadays in Canada costs about $1,300 in one clinic that I've been to before, that I know the treatment works for $1,300. It's just, it could be less than that if you only have one toenail that needs treating, but it's the kind of price where you wouldn't want to buy your own equipment if it costs more than, say, $1,000, or, you know, so that sort of thing. But to be able to eliminate the toenail fungus with like three treatments is what they give you, three separate treatments, and you're done, which is done over a period of some weeks. I'm not sure how long it takes now, but it's several treatments, only three treatments, whereas when you're using the home lasers that don't cure it, they don't cure very quickly. Maybe it never cures it. I'm not even sure, but it's very slow. It's not painful, but it's very slow, and it doesn't really seem to cure it well enough. You know, if they just could make it powerful enough, we'd have a treatment that could be used at home using these blue lasers and infrared lasers all combined in one. Somebody just needs to produce it, and they've already come in the direction of doing it. So, but the video that with Ron Wyatt's wife, I'll find it later. It's a phenomenal video. Her name is now Mary Nell Wyatt Lee, because she's apparently remarried. But Mary Nell, maybe that was her maiden name, Mary Nell, that is. But Mary Nell Wyatt was her name when she was married to Ron. And she tells a wonderful account. She's a Christian, and she has a very truthful way of expressing things. So it's very interesting. And I appreciate her more now than I did when I first saw the video. I saw it many years ago, or some years ago. Yeah, quite a few years ago now, when I was writing this article, is probably when I saw it first. But it's her account of Ron's visit to Noah's Ark. And right after he visited Noah's Ark, he went because the Ark wasn't available at that time. He couldn't get in there to work on the investigation of Noah's Ark at the time in 1977 when he first went there. So he went into Arabia at that time instead and did. And even then he couldn't get in there. Legally, he couldn't get in there, so he actually crossed the border illegally with his sons, and they got arrested and got in prison. They got in trouble. Spent some time in jail in Saudi Arabia because of having illegally crossed the border to get to Mount Sinai, what they found, which looks really, really impressive as far as being the actual site, very possibly, where the Ten Commandments were given and so on. So let's continue now, shall we, our study of the Ark of Urartu. Hallelujah! So we have found the Chinese family of Kainan. Tony might say, my hallucination is that I found Kainan. Believe it or not, the Jin and Jones appear as of Kainan. I feel like I have found the Holy Grail as I am writing. One of the things Mr. Wyatt says in a videotaped question and answer is that God doesn't use smart people for the reason that a human then might get credit for God's work based on human individual cleverness, and people may not see God working. Of course, the Bible says something like this, although it says that not many men of wisdom are called. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 25 to 29 in the New World Translation of 1984. Because a foolish thing of God is wiser than men, and a weak thing of God is stronger than men. For you behold his calling of you, brothers, that not many wise in a fleshly way were called, not many powerful, not many of noble birth, but God chose the foolish things of the world that he might put the wise men to shame. And God chose the weak things of the world that he might put the strong things to shame. And God chose the ignoble things of the world and the things looked down upon, the things that are not, that he might bring to nothing the things that are, in order that no flesh might boast in the sight of God. Barnes' commentary, Notes on the Bible by Albert Barnes, 1798 to 1870 CE was his lifespan, gives us insight on the writing of Kainan in China, since the word Sifar, referring to the easternmost extent of the place of dwelling of the sons of Shem, or Pakshat in Eber, means in Hebrew counting or writing. Genesis 10:30, Albert Barnes' Notes on the Bible. Kainan is the grandfather of Eber, above Luke 3:36. Separation, compare with Sifar, is thereby understood as referring to China, the place where the oldest continuously employed writing system was created by Kainan, i.e. Kangji, Fuxi. Their place of dwelling came to extend from Misha as far as Sifar, the mountainous region of the east, Genesis 10:30, New World Translation, 1984. What if writing was created because of the dividing of the earth, or a confusion caused by God at the Tower of Babel? Then perhaps writing might have served to preserve words, the separated peoples being aware of the confusion herein. Phineas Farsa created the Gaelic alphabet for writing about the time immediately following the confusion of languages. Also, Enmerkar, Nimrod, wrote to the Lord of Arata, Haik, after the confusion, wanting to restore one true language. In Egypt, Thoth created Egyptian hieroglyphics at the time of Nimrod, as both are son of Mizraim, Hebrew Egypt. We have here an interesting situation where four languages are all created at the same time after the Tower of Babel. This makes it particularly significant. Say when exactly. And that ends our paragraph. Chapter 2, paragraph 8, which was today's reading in the article, The Ark of Urartu, by yours truly. It just is such an exciting thing to contemplate the beginning of the creation of language. And of course, perhaps Sumerian was created at the time, or in the land. We know what land, we know the land in which Sumerian was created, right? It's from the same land as the Tower of Babel. So maybe this language, Sumerian, was the language that originated, since it dates to about the time of the deluge, or, you know, at least that's a very approximate, that's a very approximate date, probably, when they date that. The Sumerian language is probably not that old, if our chronology is correct, because our chronology says there weren't people living in Sumeria at the time of the deluge, just after the deluge. But these dates that they give for ancient languages are usually very approximate. You know, they're not that accurate. There's no way to date rocks, as we've been discovering, right? So there's no way to date any inscription made in a rock or any, for that matter, or anything like that, you know, except by, you know, typographic, or what do they call that again? They, except by the study of language and character development, which is a very inaccurate science also. They don't, and the rock itself would have nothing to do with when the writing was put on it anyway. But you can't date, but they didn't write just in rocks. They made clay tablets, but you can't date the clay as in terms of how old it is either. There's no way of knowing how old writing is. They're making these sometimes bold statements, but very inaccurate, rough, approximate dates, or date approximations, concerning the ancient languages. But the fact that Sumerian is said to date roughly to the time of the deluge is very confirming of our chronology, even if it's 500 years later that it was created, which it apparently is. And then we could see that Sumerian could be the language of Enmerkar or Nimrod, or the people that came shortly after that, or the people who actually it would be after that, right? Because we don't believe there was written, we don't have any need to believe there was a written language prior to that. That is, prior to the confusion of languages at the Tower of Babel. After the confusion of languages, people would be concerned, well, how are we going to keep track of the language unless we write it down? I know the benefit of writing things down because I've been keeping notes for many, many years, so I know that there's a benefit in writing things down. I keep notebooks, and I have, nowadays, of course, with computers, everything is kept stored. You can store things in file folders and keep track of things in many ways that are, you know, similar to keeping a notebook also. But, you know, the power of note keeping, wow, it's so important. And the idea of language having developed just at the time of the Tower of Babel is such a powerful idea. It rings so true. And it just opens up a lot of doors, many of which, most of which, I haven't had the time to investigate because I've been busy with the overall study of the chronology and so on. So maybe eventually we'll get back into this and study some of it, and maybe we won't. But maybe someone will. I won't, perhaps, ever get back to it. I may never get back to doing that particular area of research, because there are so many different areas of research in which, you know, I might become involved. But somebody might do it. That's the thing. Somebody might have an interest in that and might take that up and spend a good portion of their, maybe even their life's work, you know, studying that. It's something that would be potentially enormously rewarding to study, I would think, is the origins of written language. And the fact that we have China being such this such a wonderful, wonderful symbolic language, of course, and it also the fact that it preserved the idea of Noah's Ark in the writing, and the fact that it has the evidence of being such an old writing system because of that and because of other things, but it's the oldest continuously employed writing system, is what they say here. Somebody said, anyway, somewhere. I didn't give us a source for that idea, why it's believed to be the oldest writing system continuously employed. That's very probably not a certainty, but it is interesting that it's considered very old, that the Chinese language is so old, and that we can connect it to Kainan, a biblical figure. And also, isn't it true that Japanese and Chinese languages, I want to look that up. Let's look it up and see what we can find it. There's something called kanji, right? Chinese-derived characters in Japanese writing. They're the logographic Chinese characters adapted from Chinese script used in the writing of Japanese. Right. So the kanji, they're even used in the Japanese language. And kanji is this word that resembles Kangji, the name of the man who created it, whose name also resembles Kainan. So the kanji is just more proof in the Japanese language for the existence of the creator of the language, Kainan, from the Bible, who was from the Bible, the son of Arpakshad, who was the son of Shem, right? So Kainan being the great-grandson of Noah, Shem, son of Noah, Arpakshad, son of Shem, Kainan, son of Arpakshad, Shelah, son of Kainan, Heber, son of Shelah, right, is the descendancy there. We can go back and take a look at it again in our earlier table here. Right, and we identified in the Chinese culture Nuwa as Noah, Yu Chao as Shem, Sui Ren as Arpakshad, Fu Shi as Kainan. I should really make it a little bit smaller so we can see it. Yan Di as Shelah, Huang Di as Eber, the Yellow Emperor, Jin Tian as Joktan, a very similar name too, doesn't it sound? And Xuan Shu, unidentified, okay. But the interesting thing is the brother of Joktan was Peleg, and he was born right around the time of the Tower of Babel, as the Bible also points out. Or in his days, it says, the earth was divided. The dividing of the land occurred in 2741 in our chronology, and Peleg's born in 2749 in our chronology. There's more to say about that, but that's enough for today, I think, about the specifics of all these things that are fixed by our chronology, or, you know, firmed up so that we have some firmness to our chronology, the genealogy, as we call it. So that's it for the study of the Ark of Urartu. If we can continue now with Thor Heyerdahl's The Raw Expeditions, the movie from 1972, which talked about the expedition begun in 1969. May 25th they set out, as we learned yesterday. So let's continue, shall we? First of all, let me resize. Jehovah willing here, let's resize this. There we go. And I'll unresize it for restoration purposes. later on. Okay. Here we go.
Ra is towed by Moroccan fishermen out of the harbor.
We were seven men from seven countries. I wanted to show that people are people, no matter where they come from. So our flags from east and west, north and south, were flanked by two blue flags of the United Nations. Planes and boats follow for a few hours. Then they are alone on the Atlantic, swept by strong currents southward along the Moroccan coast. The trade winds fill the sails. If only the reed bundles will continue to float, if only they will hold together, the west winds and currents will carry them to America. Sinbad the duck, intended for the cooking pot, but never eaten. Her playmate Safi, a parting gift. At the outset, the first of a series of troubles. The one professional seaman aboard, Baker, falls ill with fever. All the rest are landlubbers, including Safi, who's more interested in the provisions than the condition of the boat. Then, the first day out, more serious trouble. The rudders, both of them, snap under the force of the waves. Without rudders, they drift and wallow helplessly in hazardous waters off the rocky coast of the Sahara. Effort to keep the stern in the wind, they lower their oars in makeshift fashion into the place of the rudders. But then more trouble strikes. The yardarm breaks and the sail has to come down. No rudder, no sail. They throw out the sea anchor and hope for the best. The American navigator remains in bed with fever for three more days, treated by the Russian doctor. But then he's at the masthead, superintending repairs, and Carlo Mori is ingeniously repairing the broken rudder bay with rope. They are for a moment optimistic. No sooner are the oars set to function as rudders than they break again. The Pirates is giving no trouble at all, but the wooden part of the boat is snapping and splintering like matchsticks. The compass is useless. Rob drifts, and the crew worries constantly about smashing against rocks or being run over by ocean-going ships. To Heyerdahl's immense relief, he discovers that although his rudder is completely broken, two vertical oars, which are secured in the forward section, help to steady the boat. The boat is stabilized. A week passes. America is still a long way off. The trade wind fills the sails. They cannot do otherwise, they find, than follow the current. During our close contact with the sea, we discovered to our horror that the Atlantic is polluted. All the way, even out in the mid-ocean,
we sailed through regions full of asphalt-like lumps of oil. It was an unexpected and shocking discovery, which we reported to the United Nations.
As long as the stern remains intact, Ra rides like a swan over the waves. Everyone is safe and dry on board for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Norman, the navigator, finds the latitude with his sextant, Heyerdahl with his homemade noseometer.
Okay, so I think that's all we're going to watch for today. That was quite interesting, wasn't it? That they did have real difficulties on their expedition. And the wooden parts, this is, as an engineer, I'm fascinated by that because you know, or I know as an engineer, that the strength, I'm trying to think which the tensile strength, or is it the shear strength, or is it both? I'm trying to think. Tensile would be the stretching when you're pulling on a thread or on a rope or on a stick of wood, you pull. That's tensile. Or even bending it is also tensile because you're putting tension on one side of the piece of wood when you bend it. You compress one side and you tense the other side. That is a tensile force which will break the wood through tensile forces and depending on the tensile strength of the wood. But shear strength would be when you're trying to cut, when you have a piece of wood that's all one piece, but you've got like, you've got two other pieces sitting on top of it, and one of them moves downward, and there's no opportunity for the wood to bend, and that would be a shearing force where the piece underneath would be sheared right off, cut right off, like with scissors, you know, right? It's the same idea as with scissors, moving one piece moving down relative to the other, and any piece that's situated in between below that would be sheared off, right? If it's held in place, that is, and can't move downward, it would be sheared off. So that's a shear force, and so shear strength, they tend to be similar for wood. Tensile and the shear strength tends to be similar numbers in pounds per square inch. So the number of square inches is the area that you find is relevant to that, right? The cross-sectional area of the beam of wood, if you were to look down the end of it, you'd see the cross-sectional area of the, if it were a constant thickness, that you'd just look at the end of it, you'd see that area. That would determine its strength, because the idea of pounds per square inch being involved there, but it's not that. When you talk about strength, it's actually more like the cube and not the square. So when you're doing an area of something, it's like the width, if it's a square, it's the width times the height would be the width squared, because it's a square. So it's just the square inches becomes the dimension squared if it's the same dimension in both directions. It would just be square that size. A 2-inch piece of wood that's 2 by 2 would be 2 squared is 4 square inches. That becomes the relevant number for anything that is related to the area or the cross-sectional area of that wood, right? But it's not really like that. So even though that relates to the tensile and the shear strength of materials, which are expressed in pounds per square inch, that is relevant in calculating those numbers. But when you consider how strong a piece of wood is, or a piece of anything, steel or any material, it goes, strength really, or the rigidity of it, really goes, is proportional not to the area of the cross section, but to the whatever the dimension is. Like if it's round, right, then, or if it's square, doesn't matter, but as long as it's the same in two perpendicular directions, the same width and same height, it goes as the cube of that. So not just the square, not just the width times width, but width times width times width. It's width cubed that gives you the rigidity or the strength or the... it's a more useful way of evaluating when you're an engineer how strong something is. It goes as the cube of the dimension, of the cross-sectional dimension for strength. So you want something, if you want something, if you make it twice as big, that means that's 2 times 2 times 2, twice as big in those two directions, but it becomes 2 times 2 times 2 when you cube the number 2 is 8. 2 times 2 times 2 is 8, which is 8 times stronger because you've made it twice as large in both directions. It becomes 8 times stronger. So that is significant because it shows that when these men are making these oars, you know, they made their oars, but they didn't calculate the forces. They didn't estimate the forces accurately enough and use a wood that was strong enough with a big enough dimension to prevent being snapped, right? Because you can't have the tensile strength be exceeded, or the breaking strength. You can't exceed that even once. If you exceed the breaking strength even once, it breaks and then it's done. So, yeah, you have to make sure your material's large enough in dimension to accommodate the largest force that you're going to encounter. So even if they'd made their oars, the diameter of their cross-section of the oars, if they'd made it twice as big, it would have been 8 times as strong. So that could have been plenty, maybe, right? But it would have been more unwieldy to lift those things also, to make them twice as big in dimension. But that's just a thought that comes to me as an engineer when I'm seeing something snapping. It says they didn't calculate the forces. They didn't estimate them correctly. They didn't do any proper analysis that would have been required in order to determine what would snap and what wouldn't snap. They made no attempt, it looks like, to actually calculate that. So that's pretty well it. I think we're almost out of time. It's Sunday. It's September 22nd. 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 16:43 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now. Thank you for listening and watching, and this was Chapter 2, Paragraph 8 of the Ark of Urartu that we did today. And we got a couple more seconds. Yeah, I'm shopping for all these interesting leather buckles for belts and things like that. I've been shopping for the possible ways of attaching as well these buckles and the different kinds of buckles that are available and the different leathers and things like that. Just shopping, not purchasing right now. But the shopping is a big thing, too, just to enjoy the shopping part of it. So bye for now.